somebody else comes.
Yeah, there'll be other people. There's actually that sheet I'm going to take back.
This one?
That one. That one that I didn't mean to give out. Yeah, that one I didn't mean to give out. Just the one that's, just this one, this one you should have.
Wait a minute.
You got the wrong one?
We have
You got the wrong sheet.
So you want these all back?
And you can keep them. It's just an extra copy of what I gave out last week, but that's not the one I was going to use. This is the one I wanted to use. So you can keep them or you can give them back. Whatever you want. I don't care. They're for you. I don't need them.
Okay, yes, I have that one.
Yeah,
that
you
gave
one
it out
too.
Last week,
I did. I gave them both out last week, but we're going to start with the second one.
I must have that one.
What a rowdy crowd here.
Yeah, we're just ready to go. Monday morning, you know.
Monday morning quarterbackers.
You get the Monday. Well, that was last night, actually, but the quarterbackers.
What Monday morning?
Yeah, the Super Bowl. Monday? Super Bowl. Yes. Quarterback, yeah. Right?
But that's what I'm saying is people are still hyped up from the Super Bowl.
That's it. All right, let's.
I won most games with Gin Rummy, so I'm really hyped up.
Do you understand?
I will remind everybody that we record these forums, so everything you say goes on the internet. Every word goes on the internet.
Okay.
Just to let you know. Suddenly it's quiet. Okay. Towards the end of the class last week, we began to look at a way of resolving, only by making matters worse, but a way of resolving the mystery of the sequence of events in the story of Pelegish Begiva. In addition to the intensity and the sort of evil or calamity, tragedy of the events that we looked at, we also had some enormous questions about how things unfolded. How would they, the Overtones, send them into war more than three times, and twice one side won, once another side won. They destroy Shevet Binyamin, they come to the base to the Mishkan and Shiloh. They're crying about the destruction of Binyamin, and then they go wipe out Yavesh Gilad. The Yavesh Gilad, because they didn't come to the war. One oath about not marrying Binyamin, another oath about not by killing anybody, didn't come to the war, and then they go and kill them all. So we had suggested that the mystery would be more easily understood if we took the story of Yavesh Gilad and literally cut and paste, cut it out of where it is, not literally, but figuratively, understanding that that's really an earlier event. And it's a significant earlier event because it's the key to understanding what transpired in the war with Binyamin. So if we took that battle of Yavesh Gilad and we moved it from its written location in Perikof Aleph, and we saw it as an event that occurred actually not only in the midst of the war with Binyamin, but actually even before the war with Binyamin, as kind of the work up to it, then it helps us understand a number of things. Right, certainly it resolves the issue of Perikof Aleph and what happened after the war, the come to the Mishkan, the not remorsing over Binyamin and then going and slaughtering Yavesh Gilad in the same breath. Right? They're essentially acknowledging after all of the tempers have calmed down and the blood pressure has come back down to normal, then suddenly they realize that they essentially didn't have one tragedy, they had two, actually had three. Binyamin, which had been decimated in the war, but Binyamin essentially had been the subject of two tragedies. The calamity of the war itself is tragedy number one, and the oath not to marry the children of Binyamin, which was essentially a second level of the tragedy, because it added to the possibility that Binyamin would be, in fact, extinct. So to that, they added the possibility of taking the survivors of the third tragedy, which was the war with Yavesh Gilad, and using that event as a kind of way of rehabilitating the people of Binyamin, kind of in some way, some kind of small remorse or tikkun, because you sort of take the survivors of Yavesh Gilad and use them and encourage them to help rehabilitate the people of Binyamin. So that led us back to Perek Chaf, and that's really where I want to go back to the story today, because that's where we left off, which was to understand where in the midst of the war with Binyamin did this story of Yavesh Gilad fit in, and what is the significance? This war with Yavesh Gilad is really, we've only begun to scratch the surface of what this war was and what its significance was. And it will have significance for us, it will resonate for us for generations. For generations, and I will show you why I say that towards the end of our study of Sefer Shoft, which, by the way, is coming to a close soon. Mitzvah Hashem before Pesach is my goal. My new goal.
New goal.
My new goal. All right. So what you have on this sheet that I just gave you is a sort of outline of all of the sequence of events in the story as ordered not by the, in the sequence not of the text, but in the suggested sequence of events that we have now put forward, including where we put in the red the story of Yavesh Gilad. Now, I don't know if I emphasized this when we met last week, but I want to go back to one point in the text itself. So for this, let's look, go back to the Tanakh and look at Sukkim Yud, starting with Yud Bet.
320.
Let's actually go back just a little bit. Let's go back to Pasuk Tet. V'yata zeh hadavar asher na'aseh la'giva. This is all of Israel gathered together. This is where the emphasis at the beginning of the perek was on the unity of Israel. Phrases like Vayishmu b'nei binyamin ki alu b'nei Yisrael came to Mitzpeh, and Kol ha'am, the entire nation, Kol shivtei Yisrael, all the tribes of Israel. Pasuk Chet 8. Vayakom kol ha'am ki ish echad lemor, the people arose like with one, like one person, like with one voice. Right, we're not going home until we deal with this problem. This is when they're right. The drums of war were beating. V'yata zeh davar asher na'aseh la'giva aleha bagaral. We're going to war against Giva. Right, charge. Now at this point, their war is with whom?
Giva.
We'll make the, this is very important for us. At this point, the war is with Giva. V'lekachnu asara anashim le'me'ah l'chol shivtei Yisrael u'me'ah le'elef elef l'ravava. Divide the war, divide the army, divide 400,000 into different platoons and different groups. Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayasef kol ish Yisrael el ha'ir ki ish echad chaverim. They approached the city like one. Chaverim. Talked about that phrase once before. So at this point, the war is clearly focused on Giv'ah. Vayishlechu shivtei Yisrael anashim b'chol shivtei Binyamin lemor. Then they send messengers amongst the people of the tribe of Binyamin to ask, to say to them, what is this terrible thing that you've done? What happened here? What just happened? In focus on this transition between Psukim Yud Yud Aleph to Yud Bet, something happened here. They approached the city, they surrounded the city, charge, all unified together, 400,000. Then they send messengers to the tribe of Binyamin to say to them, right, individuals, amongst all the people, the cities of Binyamin. Tnu et anashim b'nei Belial asher b'giva nimitem univara ra'ab Yisrael. Give us the perpetrators of this evil deed. What happened to the war with Giva? What happened to Aleh b'Goral? Right, wipe out Giva. Right? Goral means a war. What happened to that charge against the city of Givah. Suddenly they're negotiating with the people of Binyamin to hand over the perpetrators. Two psukim ago, they were going to wipe out the city of Givah. Now suddenly they're negotiating over the handing over of the perpetrators.
So wasn't this like a from the mitzvah that you have to...
If they were thinking rationally enough, maybe. But it doesn't sound to me, when you deal with psukim like Zer Davar Hashem Aseh LaGivah Aleha BaGoral charge, right? It doesn't sound like a rational statement. So what happened to this momentum, this lynch mob that was charging in the city of Givah? Suddenly they're negotiating with the people of Binyamin.
Could it be a classic case of cold feet when they came up against their enemy when they realized what
I think
what
they
it
got
was
to the city of Givah.
Pretty well fortified.
They got to the city of Givah, and what I wanted you to, what I said, pay attention to the transition between Yud Aleph and Yud Bet. In the Tanakh, there's a paragraph break.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we talked about this once before. Those paragraph breaks are very strategic. They indicate many things, but sometimes they indicate just a pause. Aleh b'Goral charge, they get to the wall and they stop. They have lunch. Right? They looked at the wall. They looked at the wall. They looked at the fortification. And suddenly they decide, you know what? Why don't we change tactics? Why don't we send a negotiating team to see if we can't extradite the perpetrators? And what do we need the war for? So they send these messengers and they say to the people of Binyamin, give us the evil people. Mm-hmm. Right? Give us the evil people.
And not the whole city.
Now, Pasuk Yud Dalet is the critical Pasuk. Because the response of Pasuk Yud Dalet makes no sense. The response of Pasuk Yud Dalet is Vayasfu b'nei Binyamin min ha'arim ha'giv'ata latzet l'milchama im b'nei Yisrael. B'nei Binyamin gathered together at Givah to go out to war against Bnei Yisrael. Their response wasn't just to say no. Their response was, let's say la milchama. We have presented this war heretofore. We have presented this war as a war of Shiftei Yisrael against Binyamin. Givah or Binyamin. Binyamin to defend Givah. But if you look carefully at the transition to Pasuk Yud Dalet, Pasuk Yud Dalet states that Bnei Binyamin gathered together latzet lemilchama in Bnei Yisrael. And in fact, the army that gets together and to fight Israel is the army of Binyamin. Vayitpaktu Bnei Binyamin b'yom ahu. Bnei Binyamin gathered together their forces from the cities, 26,000. Drawn swords, beside Levad miYoshvei Hagivait Paktu 700 Ish Bachur, in addition to the 700 sharpshooters and marksmen that of Givah, the people of Givah that can who are left-handed and can shoot a hare with a stone from a distance and not miss. Why is the Navi telling us all of this? Why is the Navi telling us how skilled warriors the people of Givah are? These 700 Bachurim from Givah who are sharpshooters, who are marksmen. Why is it relevant?
Foreshadowing what's going to happen?
Possibly, but I would do it in reverse. They get to Givah, and what do they encounter?
The sharpshooters.
Right? They encounter the fact that these people of Binyamin and these people of Givah are not sitting ducks. Right? They're fortified, they're uniformed, they're organized, they're regular army, they're quite capable of defending themselves. Okay. So the whole transition to from Pasuk Yud Gimel to Pasuk Yud Dalet, the center of gravity of this story shifts dramatically from the people of Bnei Yisrael, energized, ready to go, Aleh b'Goral, down, charge, kill, go, right? To the city of Givah, wipe them out, to negotiations and messengers and conversations, and suddenly they're looking at an organized army and sharpshooters and marksmen and they're afraid.
Getting cold feet.
Right? Now it's true. Pasuk Yitzayin, v'ish Yisrael itbakdu. There's another paragraph break. Ish Yisrael itbakdu levan mibinyamin abamiot elafish leif charev. Israel's got 400,000. So you'd think by sheer numbers, 400,000 against 26,000, that you shouldn't have a problem. And yet, v'yakumu v'yalu Betel. They take an about face. They go all the way up to Betel. To do what?
To talk to God
to find out about the Umvitum. So the biggest mystery, I think, is this intimated, insinuated reference that maybe Binyamin fired the first shot. Now, this war didn't start from Israel. This war started from Binyamin. And the question of why.
Well, isn't that what you told us last week?
So that's what I said at the end of the class last week, is that I think into that break is where we would insert the story of Yavesh Gilad. And go back to this sheet now, and then essentially the rest of the story, this is where we left off. We sort of started doing this at the end of the class, but very quickly. So this is really when we'll start with. Right. The first part is Israel gathers in Mitzpeh. They listen to the story of the Levi. They declare their intent to avenge the death of the Pilegesh. Up to Pasuk Aleph, everything's good. They're going to avenge the blood of this poor Pilegesh. Then, in Pasuk Yud Bet, which is not on this. And they start to ask questions. They request extradition, and they begin to negotiate. Give us the people. Binyamin clearly refuses. And at this moment, they're faced with a difficult dilemma. Their plan didn't go according so well. But their original plan was,
go to war
with Binyamin. They get to Giva. They get to Giva, and they're a lot stronger and a lot more defended than they thought. So they start an alternative tactic. Alternative tactic number one, they take an oath. Binyamin, either give us the perpetrators or face the consequences that we will...
Not go to war yet.
Face the consequences that we will take an oath. That our children will never marry your children. Oath number one of the story of Binyamin. Why? Because, right? It's a threat. It's a way of, as we used the analogy last week, sanctions. Right? Mm-hmm. It's a way of saying to them, you know, we'll apply other pressures first, avoid the war. Right now, suddenly they want to put the brakes on this war, and of course, Binyamin calls their bluff. So they take this oath, and Binyamin says, you guys are ridiculous. What are you doing here? You're going to take an oath that you're never going to marry us? How dare you? We never hear the response of B'nai Binyamin to this oath, but this oath was public. And we know it was public, because if it wasn't public, how could the tribes not have heard, you know, how could all the tribes have been bound by it? And how could they could not annul this oath? Like, this had to have been a public oath, or else it wouldn't have been relevant to every single tribe of Israel that was there in the war. So a public oath that our children are never going to marry your children. What's Binyamin's response to such an oath? They sit there and do nothing? I suspect they begin to gather their forces together. How dare you?
Well, there's also the psychological embarrassment of it, in addition to the military of wanting to do that. There's a terrible embarrassment there.
They are going to defend their honor, 100%. They are going to defend their honor. How dare you? Then Israel responds, oh, you're going to start to come to war with us? You're going to start gathering your forces against us? One second. Know who you're dealing with. This is 400,000 soldiers. This is the united front of Israel. This is the combined army of every tribe of Israel. Not so every tribe. Not so united. Every tribe. We're all accounted for. I'll prove it to you. Gather together the councils and the elders. Make an oath. Any tribe of Israel who's not here shall be put to death. Oath number two.
Another stupid oath.
But in the heat of battle, and in with tempers climbing, and the tensions rising, escalating, people do stupid things. So the first oath, not to marry Binyamin. Now the second oath, to prove that everybody was there.
You're not there.
Right? You're not there, you're out.
You're dead.
Right? You're dead. And then they wanted to prove to the Binyamin that this census was real, that they meant business. Now they can't fight Binyamin quite yet because they ain't going to war against Binyamin directly because
Gilead didn't show up.
Well, before Gilead, right, Israel, the forces of Israel, they can't just go to war against Binyamin directly. Because
they're outnumbered.
Well, they're not outnumbered. They outnumber Binyamin, but they are outgunned. They're outskilled. Right? They're outskilled. They're not as organized. How many wars in Israel in the world have been decided in favor of the smaller army, but the more organized army, right? The more skilled fighting force. This is a single militia of Shevet Binyamin against a ragtag group of militias combined from volunteer forces from all of Israel.
They don't know who's even leading them.
They don't know who's leading them, and it's not clear. We'll find out who's leading them in a second. But it's not clear that they are there voluntarily. Look at Yavesh Gilad. Right? By the time the oath comes around, right, it's not impossible to suggest or to imagine that many of those people who are there because they were pressured to be there. Right?
Kol Echad. Is this the first civil war?
No, it's the third.
The third?
We've already had two. They are? They are? We had two in Shoftim already.
One with Gidon.
Gidon against the people of Penuel and Sukkot. And Yiftach against B'nai Ephraim, right? We're going to come back to those two stories towards the end of the discussion today. So at that point, they take this major oath as if they are the kingdom, and they are the nation of Israel, they are the Malchus. The Ramban describes it as the Takanata Kahal, the law of the community, and they have the right, and therefore, to enforce it. And they go up, and they say, who's not here? Every tribe accounted for except Yavesh Gilad, subfamily of Manasseh, east of the Yarden. So in taking all their wrath and their anger and their tension and their trigger-happy moment of bloodthirst, and instead of directing it at Binyamin, where they are going to encounter a strong army, they take all that wrath and they empty it on the innocent people of Yavesh Gilad. And they wipe them out. And the description of the war against Yavesh Gilad is really horrendous. It's more horrendous than the description of the war against Binyamin, because the war against Binyamin was against the people who had A, perpetrated the crime in the first place, and then defended the perpetrators of that crime.
And beaten them in battle, too. They caused a lot of death and casualties.
The war with Yavesh Gilad was a people who had no guilt, no involvement.
Except they didn't show up.
They wanted to stay out of this.
Right.
Neutral.
Right.
For that crime, the war against, and the description of how they fought Yavesh Gilad is far worse than how they fought Binyamin. Because by Yavesh Gilad, the psukim describe a very different kind of battle. Take a look at, you have it either in the Hebrew on the page over here, or if you have a Hebrew English Tanakh and you want to look at the text, it's in Perek Chaf Aleph, Psukim Yud to Yud Bet. But when they discover that Yavesh Gilad sat this one out, right? When they discover that Yavesh Gilad sat this one out, Pasuk Yud, Vayishlechu Sham Ha'eda, Shneim Asar Elef Ish Mibnei Achayel. They sent 12,000 delegates from the war.
21.
Vayitzavu otam lemor, luchu vikitem et yoshvei Yavesh Gilad lefichereth. Go and smite the people of Yavesh Gilad by the sword. V'hanashim v'ataf, with women and children. V'zeh davar asher ta'asu, in the following formula. Kol zachar, v'chol isha yodat mishkav zachar, tachavimu. All the men and all the women who are let's call it eligible age, or married, or who were married, or who are possibly married, destroy, wipe out. Leaving 400 young maidens just at the edge of, or at the cusp of, being old enough to be married. And they bring those to Shiloh. Now, we had a discussion, I don't know if you remember, where to put this pasuk. Is this pasuk post the rehabilitation effort? Or is this last pasuk about the 400 maidens part of the war? I'm going to suggest, not as I originally made these sheets, where I put it part of the rehabilitation effort, I'm going to reverse course and suggest that, in fact, that pasuk's part of the war. And when they go to the war, they go with the intent of wiping out the males, and the females who were eligible, old enough to be married, and they take as captives, for some strange and inexplicable reason, 400 maidens, young girls. Which at that point, the reason for their taking those 400 maidens may not be clear. But they take them, they send them up to Shiloh. And they wipe out Yavesh Gilad. Now, in a couple of weeks I'll show you the lineage, because I don't want to take us off target here, but there is a very old marriage connection between Binyamin and Yavesh Gilad. Goes back to the days of the Avot. Wow. Which may explain why Yavesh Gilad didn't want to get involved in this war. It would also explain
why Binyamin
took it personally.
Because of the connection.
Not only do you take an oath against us, that you're never going to marry us, but the one city in Israel that decided to stay neutral, and you go and wipe them out, men, women, and child. We have no information of how large that city was and how many people died in that battle. But I'll make a guess. What's my guess?
26,000.
No, 40,000.
Right.
The same number. That
right.
Yeah.
So it's measured.
Because the Ramban has already made the formula, right? 40,000 Israelites die in the first 2 days of battle. 40,000 Binyaminites, 25,000 soldiers and 15,000 civilians die in on the third day of Binyamin. Tit for tat.
It's measured
from that. Right? Okay, so let's add a third element to the group. So the whole story is really about three battles, not two. Mm-hmm. It's about the war Yavesh Gilad part one. Israel against Binyamin against Israel to avenge Yavesh Gilad, part two, and Israel against Binyamin to avenge the Pilegesh, part three. And if the Ramban has set out the formula, 40,000 Israelites died on the first 2 days, why? I can only guess. And the Ramban suggested because I didn't ask the Yom V'Tumim correctly. Remember the Gemara? That's what they asked the Urim V'Tumim correctly. We'll come back to the Urim V'Tumim's role in all of this. But for whatever reason, right, the Urim V'Tumim sent them into war and then let them lose as a punishment for the innocent slaughter of Yavesh Gilad. And what moral right do you have to go and avenge the blood of Yavesh Gilad when your hands have just spilled the blood of an entire innocent city? You want to go avenge the blood of one innocent person, you've just killed 40,000. So you first have to find yourselves punished for the slaughter of Yavesh Gilad. And only then can we begin to talk about the vengeance against the poor Pilegesh who got forgotten in all of this.
You also have a lot of time that's going to last because they've got to go, they go from Givah, all the way over to Gilad, which is a nice distance, and back to Shiloh. I mean, you're talking about a period of, what, a year, 2 years? At least several months.
Not so big. It's 20 kilometers from here to here.
Yeah, but then look where Gilad is. They've got to go up to Gilad. Well, we don't.
Gilad's over here.
Well, still some distance. I mean, you're not.
So there they sent 12,000 soldiers.
Yeah.
Right, the rest of the army is here.
I know. It still could be some time involved.
Probably days. I don't think weeks or months, but it could be done in days. Remember, Yavesh Gilad was neutral. They were not defenseless.
They weren't ready
for the slaughter.
Nope.
Right? So I don't think it took too long. but certainly enough for the tempers to... It also adds one more dimension to our discussion, which is one of the most difficult sources we looked at, which was the Gemara that suggested, on the one hand, that remember the Gemara that compared the story of Pelegish Begivat to Pasamicha? Suggested, on the one hand, that God tolerated the idol of Micha because he was hospitable to neighbors. And then in the next breath said that when we went to war with Binyamin, we lost that war as a punishment. For what? For not protesting the dignity of God. Bichvodi lo machitem. My honor, my dignity, you didn't protest. But bichvod basar badam, but the dignity of human beings, then suddenly you came to protest. So the way we originally understood that statement was,
I'm going to modify it now. When it came to the honor of Hashem, lo machitem, you did not protest. You were silent. Whereas when it came to chvod basar v'dam, and then suddenly you protest, which we originally, when we read the Ramban, suggested meant, and when it came to my honor, was a reference to the idol of Micha. That you stayed silent about, that you didn't say anything, that you protested. Whereas when it came to Chvod Basar V'dam, human being, there, your own honor, that was a reference to the Pilegesh. Then suddenly you are all hot on the collar and ready to pounce. And therefore, God says you'll be punished. Now, the problem we raised with that interpretation was that it places defense of the honor of God on a higher scale than defense of the honor of man, and that's contrary to the whole theme of the sense of morality in the Nevi'im, and the whole theme of that Gemara, which was to tolerate Micha's idol because he cared about people and he was hospitable. So it's a self-contradiction. So here's what I'm going to say. What I heard from Rav Meidan, suggestion that this is the wrong application of this Gemara. When it says, Bichvodi, my honor, lo machitem, you is silent, whereas when it came to Basar V'dam, suddenly you protested. It's not about Pesach Micha. This is a reference to the Pilegish. And this is a reference to the Yiddishkeit. Wow. Because the war with Yavesh Gilad was fought why?
Stupid oath.
An oath taken by
Israel.
It was essentially a war to defend the honor of and the integrity of the decree of the people of Israel. So to defend the people against the violation of the decree of the people of Israel, you went to war and slaughtered 40,000 innocent souls.
It was just the soldiers of Israel.
Right? Whereas...
It wasn't the women.
Right. Whereas when it came to the defense of when it came to avenging the perpetrators of a crime that was clearly a biblical violation and a crime against the core essence of morality of the human being and the soul and the dignity of the human soul, which is a reflection of the honor of God, that war should have been justifiable, but you spoiled it, you ruined it. Because instead of going to war with Binyamin over the Pilegesh, which you should have done right away, you detoured. And you started playing games with the Yavesh Gilad. Suddenly, your honor and your decree and your oaths to Yavesh Gilad, that's more important than the war, than the intended target, which was the perpetrators of Giv'ah and the perpetrators of a crime, which was a violation of Kvod Hashem. Had they gone straight to Giv'ah and dealt straight with Binyamin, that war would have been justified. So first you have Yavesh Gilad, and then you have days 1 and 2 with Binyamin, and then you have day 3 with Binyamin. Yavesh Gilad is Israel's crime. they are punished for it in the first two battles of Binyamin. In a certain sense, and Ayin, you'll forgive me, the scale is now, the slate is now balanced, and now we go to day three, where the vengeance is against Binyamin for their crime against the Pelegish, which is where this story started.
How come Hashem never interferes when Israel's doing something really stupid? It's always like after the fact.
Because that's the power of free choice.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You have the power to be stupid. You have the right, the authority, and the ability to be stupid. But you'll pay the consequences for it.
But you'll pay the consequences.
Correct. And you'll pay the consequences for it for exactly that reason.
But it doesn't help Yavesh Gilai.
No. It doesn't help Yavesh Gilai. But that's the way the world, in a sense, that's the way God created the world. You have the right to destroy
it. That's the reference to an unredeemed world.
Do you have some suggestions to where on the chronology you have here? Yavesh Gilai, was that before Israel went to negotiate with Binyamin or after?
I think it's right in the middle. They're in the middle of the negotiation with Binyamin, and Binyamin begins to respond by saying no. So they start with sanctions, and they start with unity, coalitions. And when Binyamin continues to say no, they said, we'll prove it to you. We're serious. We mean what we say. All options on the table. Right? Here's the oath. Here's the unity of Israel. Anybody doesn't come, we're going to kill them. And they do.
So,
and then Binyamin responds, and it's not an accident. I think Binyamin fires the first shot in the war.
But is the implied assumption here that if Bnei Israel hadn't wiped out Yavesh Gilai, we might have had
a different outcome?
That Binyamin would have forced Gibeah to turn over the people? Is that
no, clear? I think that they would have ended up in war, but I think that we would have gone straight to stage three.
Okay.
And Binyamin would have lost the war, and there would never have been an oath. And we never need to rehabilitate Binyamin, but they would have lost the war. And they would have, that would have been a very different character. Now, so evidently this story revolves around two oaths. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Evidently this story revolves around two oaths. The oath not to marry Binyamin, and the oath against Yavesh Gilad. We have a mechanism for dealing with difficult oaths. How do we deal with difficult oaths normally, appropriately? Atarat nedarim, right? You make a mistake, you take a terrible oath, you have an option, right? You can absolve the oath, you can annul the oath.
We're not very good at that either.
We're not very good at that either. And the truth is that in the Medrash, Chazal took, remember the story of Pinchas, of Yiftach? And the oaths with Yiftach?
Yeah.
And remember we had this whole Medrash about Pinchas, suddenly Pinchas ended up in the story of Yiftach? Chazal took Pinchas and he said, well, he was the Kohen Gadol. Yiftach should have gone to Pinchas. Pinchas should have gone to Yiftach, right? There's this whole description in the Medrash about how Pinchas played a role over there. If Pinchas played a role over there, he's 300 years old. So, leaving aside for a moment the Midrashic possibility that Pinchas could be 300 years old, Chazal put Pinchas into the story of Yiftach because Chazal wanted to draw our attention to the oaths there. Yiftach's oath in particular, both oaths. The oath to make him the people's oath to make him the leader and his oath about his daughter. Pinchas' symbol about oaths and the role he plays in not annulling oaths is a story that emerges out of our text. Because they could have annulled the oath, but to do so they have to go to the Kohen Gadol. And who's the Kohen Gadol?
Pinchas.
So now the real question is, where is Pinchas in all of this? After they finish with Yavesh Gilad, and after they anger Binyamin between the oath about marriage and the oath about Yavesh Gilad and the destruction of Yavesh Gilad, Binyamin begins to gather their army and march. So Israel, instead of fighting back, the first thing they do is, they turn an about face, they march up to Shiloh in order to seek God's advice. Right. If you look back at the Perek Chaf, from Pasuk Yud Zayin is the last moment where I have these two forces opposite each other. Binyamin 26,700, Bnei Yisrael 400,000. Pasuk Yud Chet, Vayakumu Vayalu Beit Av Vayashalu Be'Elokim. They go back to God to seek God's counsel. They go to God to seek God's counsel over of what to do. And of course, that's where the story, the failure of the Urim V'Tumim begins, where the Urim V'Tumim says to them,
go.
Go, and they end up losing. And who's directing the Urim V'Tumim? Who's sitting there with the Kohen Gadol's breastplate?
Pinchas.
So, all lines lead back to Pinchas. Oaths, Kohen Gadol is the responsible target for annulling oaths. Urim V'Tumim, Kohen Gadol. Right? Pinchas. They go to Shiloh in the middle of the battle, Pinchas. All lines go back, lead back to Pinchas. So the question is, no, it tells us in the end. It tells us in the end. The question is, why didn't Pinchas, what role did Pinchas play in all of this? That's the question. Besides the Urim V'Tumim, is there another component of his role? Essentially, if he's responsible person for annulling the oaths, why doesn't he annul the oaths? Right? If you sit there at this moment, when Chazal said, right, you didn't protest your own honor. When they took the oath about anybody didn't come to battle will be put to death, they did so in anger. Like Yaakov, when he said to Rachel, when he said to Lavan, anybody who stole your trafim shall die. It's an oath taken in anger. Oaths taken in anger don't have to be fulfilled. Oaths taken in anger can be annulled. To do so, you have to go to the Kohen Gadol. If it's a communal oath, if it's a public oath. It's called the Neder Dat Rabin. Why doesn't Pinchas, when they discover that Yavesh Gilad sat out the battle, did not come to the battle, instead of going and slaughtering Yavesh Gilad, which is a terrible crime, why doesn't Pinchas just annul the oath?
First of all, I'd have to go to them and tell them it was annulled. It wouldn't be just like, oh, he's sitting somewhere else.
Well,
and
it's the people's oath. It's the people's oath that needs to be annulled.
Right, but I'm saying if they don't know it was annulled, then they're going to fulfill it.
Fine, so they could go to Pinchas and they could say, listen, we ran into a problem. We took this oath in anger. We realized that Yavesh Gilad didn't come to battle. If we execute the literal letter of this oath, it means we're going to wipe out an innocent city called Yavesh Gilad. They did nothing. What do we do with this? And Pinchas would have said, fine, okay, so annul the oath, big deal. Not complicated. They didn't mean to take it. They didn't want to destroy Yavesh Gilad. There's certainly a petach there. There's certainly a way out. Why doesn't Pinchas annul this oath? So here's part two of the story. Part two of the story is the way in which this battle against Yavesh Gilad unfolds. It's a very strange battle with a very strange formula. What's the formula against Yavesh Gilad?
They go to Mitzpeh.
What's the formula of how they wipe out Yavesh Gilad?
They appoint 1,000.
Take 1,000 per tribe.
And they send them immediately.
They send them to Yavesh Gilad and tell them what?
Wipe out all the men. And all
men, the married women, eligible married women, old enough to know a man, married women, take the young girls. The strangest formula that has no bearing on this story whatsoever. I'm talking about the people who didn't come to wage war, so wipe out them.
Yeah,
you know, go to war. It's the strangest formula. It's a formula you use when you want to essentially make a city or a community or a tribe extinct. Because essentially you wipe out all the men and you wipe out all the married women, the potential of any unborn child. It's a mess. It's a formula you lose when you want to make a nation extinct. Not be able to continue.
It's a massacre.
Right. What business is that having the story of Yavesh Gilad? All they want to do is make their point. Now, we have only one precedent for this story, for this kind of war. There is only one precedent where this kind of war appears.
Stone?
Nope. Not a stone, and not a Malek.
Not a Malek.
This exact formula, precisely, almost verbatim, appears in only one other place in Tanakh. I'll show you where it is. First, let's put down... Unfortunately, the photocopier died, so I'm going to do this manually. What are the salient points of the war with Yavesh Gilad? Number one.
Killed a man.
Shnei Masar.
Oh.
Elef.
Oh, it has a two with a thousand from each
tribe. Shnei Masar Elef Ish. Right? 1,000 per tribe, 12,000.
Yeah. It really should be 11,000.
No,
so that's interesting. 12,000 is a representative number. Correct. You really 12,000 is a representative number. You'd have to include Levi in order to exclude Binyamin, or 1,000 per tribe is not necessarily 1,000 from each tribe. Mm-hmm. 12,000 is a very important representative number because it represents the unity of Israel, all the tribes, all of the army. Sometimes you don't have one tribe, so you compensate, but yet the number remains. So it may not necessarily be 12,000, 1,000 from each tribe as much as 1,000 per tribe, maybe. What else? Right? Lefi, Vayetzavu otam lemor lechu vehikitem et yoshvei yavesh gilad. Lefi cherev, v'anashim, v'atah. So, combatants, lefi cherev, women and children. And now to qualify, which women and children and which categories.
Right.
So we have kol zachar, v'chol isha yoda'at mishkav zachar. That's category one and two. And then we have a third category, namely Na'ara Betula Asher Lo Yad'a Ish Right, Lemishkav Zachar. They were brought to where?
Shiloh.
Ela Machaneh Shiloh. Which we originally raised as a question, when did that take place? Is that before or after the effort to rehabilitate? Is it part of the war, or is it part of the rehabilitation?
Robert, wasn't it necessity we're describing Na'ara Betula to add the additional part? Is there some reason for that to be more
descriptive? There's a whole discussion in the Gemara whether this is just by age, or actually we're talking about married women, or eligible for married women, or of age to be married. There's a whole discussion, but for now I'm just going to work with the language, because the specifics of it are less...
Right.
Significant for us as much as the language.
We haven't gotten to the Book of Kings, so that couldn't be a parallel.
We haven't gotten to
the Book of Kings.
This formula, exactly verbatim, has one precedent, and it's
previously
in
Torah.
Yeah, precedent.
Okay. Has one precedent, one war in which this precise formula was used.
President Shokin.
No. It's in Chumash.
Chumash.
It's in Chumash. It's in Bamidbar, Perek Lamed Aleph.
The beginning of the
Perek. Starting with the beginning of the Perek. Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe Lemo.
Page 200.
Nekom nikmat bnei Yisrael me'et hamidyanim. Achar te'asef alamecha. Moshe, you have one last task before you are allowed to die. Namely, you must avenge the bnei Yisrael from the crime of the Midyanim. What is the crime of the Midyanim? What are we talking about?
Weren't they the sin with Moab?
Correct. Say it again.
Sin with Moab with the...
Correct. At the end of Parshat Balak,
right.
After the end of Parshat Balak,
beginning of Pinchas.
Beginning of, well, we'll get to Pinchas in a moment, yeah. But at the end of Parshat Balak, after Bilam fails to, right, if you go back to Bamidbar Perek Chaf Hei, after Bilam fails to curse Bnei Israel,
so
Ve'yeshev Yisrael b'shitim, v'yachal ha'am liznot al benot ha'mo'av. Israel is sitting in Shittim, and they begin to be seduced by the daughters of Moab. They begin to eat their sacrifice offerings, and they're eating, and they're drinking, and they're bowing, and they're dancing, and they're doing all kinds of things. And ultimately, they start worshipping Baal. Baal was a fertility god and had fertility rituals as part of the ritual of Avodah Zarah. And all hell has broken loose. Kill the perpetrators, destroy the, before the spreads. They go and take care of all the perpetrators, and then the story of the famous story of Pinchas takes place. Now, this story goes back and forth between Moab and Midian, but for all intents and purposes, at this point in time, they are equivalent. They're together. So this person, this individual, Ish Yisrael, comes with this Midianite in public. Le'enei Moshe, le'enei kol adat b'nei Yisrael. Everybody's crying opposite the Ol Moed. They don't know what to do. Here's this perpetrator. Here's this Israelite with this Midianite in public. They don't know what to do. Everybody's standing there helpless. Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen ve'yako mitoch ha'ida ve'yikach onomach b'yado. Pinchas gets up, takes a spear, and spears them both. The Israelite and the Midianite. In the beginning of Parshat Pinchas, we are... then it tells us their names. Beginning of Parshat Pinchas, it tells us their names. Shem Ish Yisrael Amukah Sheukata Midianit Zimri Ben Salun Nasi Beit Av L'Shimoni and Isha Amukah Midianit Kozbi Bat Tzur. I have a Midianite woman and an Israelite. Pinchas, in his act of zealousness, who he's rewarded for his zealousness at that moment because of the deteriorating circumstances and this public desecration of every concept of sanctity and purity of Israel possible, and everybody, for whatever reasons, not our discussion for now, stands there helpless. Pinchas takes the law into his hands, takes the spear into his hands, and he kills them both. And for that is rewarded with the status of the Kohen Gadol as the chief spiritual policeman of Israel. Everybody with me?
Yeah.
Back to Bamidbar Perek Lamed Aleph. This is where God says, okay, it's time to deal with the Midianite. That was Pinchas. So Pinchas dealt with Kozbi Batzur, and Pinchas dealt with Zimri ben Salu, but nobody has yet dealt with
Midian.
Comes along the Torah and says, Nukom nikmat b'nei Yisrael me'eta midyanim. Perek Lamed Aleph, back to Bamid by Perek Lamed Aleph, page 200. It's time to deal with them. Vayomer Moshe el ha'am lemor, hechaltzu me'itchem anashim latzava, vayu al midyan latet nikmat Hashem b'midyan. Moshe gathers the army together, and he says, this is time to avenge God against Midian. Side point, parentheses, unrelated. God says to Moshe, it's time to avenge Bnei Yisrael. Moshe says to Bnei Yisrael, it's time to avenge God. Everybody's looking out for the other one, which is very nice. It's very nice. Fine.
Which verse are you on?
Beginning of Perek Lamed Aleph.
It's page 200.
Dalet. Bamidbar Perek Lamed Aleph. Now, this war is a war that's not just about Shevet Shimon. It's a war for all of Israel. And so, Pasuk Dalet, everybody with me?
Yeah.
Yes. Elef Lamateh, Elef Lamateh. 1,000 per
tribe.
L'chol Matot Yisrael Tishlechu Latzava. That's what you send. 1,000 per tribe sent to the army. Vayimasru Me'alfei Yisrael. The whole army, Michel Agadol, right? The whole army, Mimnei Achayel. So we send 12,000. Elef Lamateh, Shnim Asar, Elef Chalutzei Tzeva. 12,000 soldiers. In the language of Sefer Shoftim, Shnim Asar Elef Ish Mimnei Achayel. Shnim Asar Elef Chalutzei Tzeva. Moshe sends them on this war of vengeance. It's a Melchemet Nekama. Who do you think leads this war?
Pinchas.
Who would be more? Who would be
most
appropriate to lead this war? The one who symbolized the defense of the integrity of the spiritual, of the sanctity of the seed of Israel. Vayishlach otam Moshe elef lamateh, otam ve'et Pinchas ben Elazar haKohen latzava. Uklei haKodesh v'chatzotzot utra b'yado. Pinchas, with the Aaron, with the chatzotzot, with the army, 12,000 leads a band of 12,000 soldiers to fight a war of vengeance against the Midianites for their seduction of Israel. This is a war about the purity of the seed of Israel. Now, what happens next? Vayitzbu'u al Midyan kasher tzivah Hashem et Moshe ve'yahargu kol zachar. They go and attack Israel, Midian, and they kill all the males. V'malchei Midian hargu al chalaleim. They kill the kings of Midian. When you kill the kings of Midian, et Evi, et Rekem, et Zur, et Chur, et Reva, Chamesh, et Malchei Midian, et Bilam ben Baor, they kill the kings and they kill Bilam. Midian, Moab, it's all one group. So when you kill the king, generally speaking, we'll see this by Amalek, when you kill, capture, or address the king of the army of your enemy, essentially, that usually signifies the end of the war, because the rest of the people just surrender. So they killed all the males. Vayishbu b'nei Yisrael et neshei Midyan v'et tapam. But they took captives. Spoils of war. Normal rules of war, of engagement, is you can take spoils. And amongst the spoils, Eshet Yevatar, the story of the woman, right? You're allowed to take the women. The women and the children. They took a bizar. They took spoils. Possessions as well as the women and children. The rest of this for now I'm going to skip. Two, they bring all of this shalal. They bring all of this spoils. Ba'adam uva'behema, men and beast. And they bring it to Moshe and to Elazar Kohen. And they come back from this war victorious. Victorious. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayetzu Moshe ve'Elazar Kohen v'chol nesi'ei ha'eda likratam. Moshe, Elazar, they come out to greet them. V'mechutz l'machane. Vayikzof Moshe al pikudei ha'chayil. Moshe gets angry. What's he angry about? All of these soldiers who came from the army. He takes the upper echelons, the officers of this group of 12,000, and he is furious at them. The Sarei Alafim, the officers of each tribe, Sarameot, and the generals, and the captains, and the commanders, and the officers, all the way down the line. Vayomer aleihem Moshe, hachayitem kon nekeva? You left the women alive? It's the women who committed the crime. You went to war with Midian and you perpetrate and you killed the men and you killed the army and you brought home the women and children as captives. But it was the women who seduced Israel in the first place. They're the ones who were guilty of this whole episode. They caused the Magay from the first place. I sent you on a mission of Nekama, on a war of vengeance. In a war of vengeance, the goal was to make Midian extinct. Make Midian extinct, it means you kill the men, you kill the women. This is a war that was supposed to end Midian. Vata hirgu kol zachar bataf. Go now and deal with the children. Male children, v'chol isha yodat ish l'mishkav zachar. Haragu. And all the women old enough to know men kill. However, v'chol ataf banashim, asher lo yodu mishkav zachar, all the children, women, the small women who are too young to know mishkav zachar, hachayu lachem, them you can keep. Because that's already, they'll be integrated into Israel, and they already will not continue the line of Midian. That's the pasuk in the war with Midian. It was a formula given by Moshe to Pinchas to execute against the people of Midian, because he had made the mistake, the tragic mistake, of fighting a war of, call it spoils and captives, instead of a war of vengeance. Pinchas is an interesting guy.
He doesn't make the mistake again.
He doesn't make the same mistake twice. That is exactly right. Which means, I'm not sure you realize the implication of what you just said.
You mean the chronology when it occurred?
Who led the war against Yavesh Gilad?
Pinchas.
This is a formula that only one person knows. Only one person knows what this means. And that person is Pinchas. So when they send 12,000 soldiers against the people of Yavesh Gilad because they didn't come to do what? What didn't the people of Yavesh Gilad come to do? They didn't come to fight a war which was perceived and presented as a war of vengeance to avenge the blood of the Pelegish who was mass raped and violated by the people of Givan, Yavesh Gilad, and Binyamin. Which means that in Pinchas' mind, this is a war of
vengeance.
How dare Yavesh Gilad not come to the war? Yavesh Gilad's not going to come to the war. We are going to deal with it. We know how to deal with people like this. We know the formula to make a people extinct. Right? Binyamin, they're going to do it anyway. They're going to take an oath not to marry Binyamin, and they're going to wipe out the men and the women. So they're going to make Binyamin extinct. And when Yavesh Gilad sides with Binyamin, in Pinchas' mind, the audacity of it all is, we will go and make Yavesh Gilad extinct. And we will apply the same formula that we applied to, or we're supposed to apply to, Midian.
Except this is Bnei Yisrael, not Midian.
Except that. This is Bnei Yisrael. And Yavesh Gilad was claiming neutrality. And they weren't dealing with a war of vengeance. Right. And it wasn't the justified war. And to top it all off, when they go to war against Yavesh Gilad, what didn't they do? Remember, Pinchas, according to this theory, what I'm suggesting to you is that Pinchas leads the war against Yavesh Gilad. What didn't he do?
Ask the men to come out and fight for Benjamin against Benjamin.
What's glaringly missing in the war against Yavesh Gilad?
HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't sanction it like he did the war against
Benjamin. I know? How do you know that he didn't sanction it?
Doesn't tell us that he did.
How do I know?
They were at Mitzpeh when they made that oath.
Right.
They didn't go first.
Because they didn't go to the Urim V'Tumim to ask the Urim V'Tumim's advice, should they or shouldn't they go to war against Yavesh Gilad. Yavesh Gilad was not about the Urim V'Tumim. It was about their own honor. Pinchas, the Kohen Gadol. You know why he can't annul the oath? I bet he took the oath. He's the leader of the tribes of Israel. He's the one. When it comes to wars of vengeance against the protection of the purity of the seed of Israel, who's leading the charge? And who led the charge at the story of Zimri ben Salu? Pinchas. Who led the charge against Midian? Pinchas. Who led the charge against Givah and against the people of Givah? I have no doubt. Upinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron Kohen Ayo Omed Lifnehem Bayamim Ahem. Pinchas. And when Yavesh Gilad sat and out, Pinchas took 12,000 soldiers and he went and he wiped them out. And then when the army turned around and said, oh, Binyamin's going to defend themselves, we better go ask the Urim V'Tumim what to do. So they go running up to the Urim V'Tumim and they ask Pinchas, check the Urim V'Tumim, what should we do? And Pinchas checks with the Urim V'Tumim and the Urim V'Tumim says, go to war. And the Urim V'Tumim says to them, where were you and I when you slaughtered, where was I when you slaughtered Yavesh Gilad? B'chvodin lo machite. You went and you slaughtered the innocent people of Yavesh Gilad. You didn't ask the Urim V'Tumim for permission. Now you want to go to war against Benjamin, and now you ask God's permission. The story's backwards. So the Urim V'Tumim says, go. Day one.
Who shall you?
Only 25,000. We're not up to, we haven't evened the score yet. Day two. Now you'll even the score. And when you finished evening the score against Yavesh Gilad, now we can talk about Benjamin. Pinchas can't annul this oath. Because Pinchas led the battle against Yavesh Gilad. Pinchas took this oath.
His hands aren't clean.
Mm. And when Chazal talk about the fact that in the aftermath of these stories, whether it be the aftermath of Yovesh Gilad or the aftermath of Yiftach in the Midrashic language, but in the aftermath of this whole story of Shoftim, Pinchas is defrocked and deposed, it's not because he asked the Urim V'Tumim and the Urim V'Tumim gave him bad advice. It's not the advice that the Urim V'Tumim told him to go to war and they failed, for which Pinchas was deposed as the Kohen Gadol. It's because Pinchas's whole form of leadership is defined by the kanaut, the zealousness with which he led the war against Midian. What happens to Pinchas is a tragedy of what happens to zealotry when you put zealotry in a position of power. Pinchas as an individual has his moment where as a zealot, as a kana'i, he can stand up against the perpetrators of Zimri bin Salu and etc. As a zealot, there's a moment for that. But the moment you take that and you institutionalize it into the role of the Kohen Gadol, you're begging for a disaster. And when he takes that zealotry and he defines his tenure as the Kohen Gadol in the manner of the zealotry to protect, even at the cost of war, the zealotry to protect the integrity of the seed of Israel, it leads him in the war against Yavesh Gilad, and it leads him against the war against Binyamin. And in the aftermath of it all, the story is about the failure of Pinchas, not just the battles of Yavesh Gilad and Pilagesh. It's the clearest indication that Pinchas's philosophy of leadership fails them. And had to, because you can't lead by a philosophy of zealotry. If your leadership is defined by the zealotry of the kahuna, you're going to end up with the Yavesh Gilad, and you're going to end up with the Pilagesh Begiva. That's the takeaway from the Ein Melech B'Yisrael, there's no king of Israel. Pinchas is defrocked, there's no shofet to arise on a national scale, and we desperately need to restructure the leadership of Israel. That's the takeaway of the story. We have a couple of loose ends, B'Zvat Hashem, we'll finish up next week, but that's essentially the core message of the story. A couple of loose ends we will, over the next week or two, address, and then we will come back to Bayim HaMein Melech B'Yisrael, and that'll take us to the end of the prayer.